As sexual harassment scandals continue to be at the top of the national conversation, we turn to decades-old research done in Central Illinois about why people sexually harass. ISU psychologist John Pryor developed a test back in the 1980s that predicts who is likely to engage in sexual harassment. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Pryor says sexual harassment is the product of both the proclivities of a man who is wielding power in an improper way and an environment that encourages it.
So you have some men who have a proclivity, if you will, for this kind of behavior. And we actually looked at behaviors like this in controlled laboratory studies. Even men who have that proclivity, though, typically don't do that kind of behavior unless there's some sort of permission given by the social norms in the situation they're in. So if they, for example, are around somebody who provides kind of a bad role model for that sort of thing, then they're more likely to do it. Or if they see other people doing it in their environment, they're more likely to do it. But if they're in situations where there are professional norms, then they're unlikely to do it.
You actually created conditions where sexual harassment could and would happen. How did that come about? How did you find people with those tendencies? How labor-intensive is that?
You bring in say 500 people, 500 undergraduates, you put them through this thing called mass testing. And it's not done that much anymore at ISU. We used to do it every semester, but mass testing is basically you give people a variety of different kinds of questionnaires on personality dimensions, attitude dimensions, spanning a whole bunch of different things because they reflect the interest of lots of different faculty. People who would take those things, would take them in large auditoriums, they would take them with what's called an informed consent document that tells them that they're completely anonymous and they should be honest, you know, and answer these questions. And at the end of doing all that, what we would do is we would say, okay, you have the right to continue to remain completely anonymous, but if you want to help us out and do some additional studies in the future, why don't you give us your name and your phone number? And almost everybody did. So they basically divulge their identities voluntarily. So we would call them up then maybe a month later, and we would bring them into the laboratory, we would look at their behaviors under some socially engineered kinds of conditions. It's also labor intensive in that we had not only a person, usually a graduate student, who was actually conducting the study, but we also had Confederates, so women who we had trained to basically be the targets of sexual harassment that were part of the situation we were socially engineering. Now, these people were also undergraduates, and they're people who work with me. They're people who knew what they were getting into. That's one thing. It's important, so there's no surprises. Also, we did some things to try to assure their sense of security while they were participating in these things.
I was going to say, because having made yourself vulnerable or a target, there's a potential for it creeping out of the lab setting.
Well, we never had any reports of that. And the other thing that we had as a standard procedure was the women who were our Confederates, we called them, knew that at any time, if things started to get out of hand or cross the line into something that they did not feel that they could handle in some way, there was this big burly graduate student who was in the hallway, and he would come in at, you know, a second's notice. So
how far did the behavior go?
They didn't. So one of the things we looked at was something, a behavior that I generically called unsolicited sexual touching. It didn't go as far as, say, the kinds of behaviors that Trump says that he did. Didn't do that kind of thing. Nor did it involve touching a woman's breasts or something like that. It was more by putting their arms around them and squeezing their shoulders, things like that, that were what we found. So we never found women who said that our Confederates saying that, you know, he tried to touch my genitals or he tried to touch my breasts or that kind of thing. That never happened.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with John Pryor, a distinguished professor emeritus of Illinois State University in psychology. You would think, though, that people know this stuff is out of line, and yet they're still copping to it on the survey, and they're still doing it.
A couple things about that. Let me address that issue, and I think that's a good point. With regard to the survey itself, let's look at that first. Remember, when people took the survey initially, when they took this questionnaire, this likelihood to sexually harass questionnaire, they did it under conditions where they were told, you're completely anonymous here, and try to be honest because you are anonymous. And only later did they divulge their identity. So at the time they were taking the survey itself or the questionnaire itself, they were under the impression that they would continue to be anonymous. So that was one part. The other thing is, when you look at what we found in those studies, and this is a real important part of our findings, people do these kinds of things under circumstances where there's some sense of which these kinds of behaviors have been permitted or legitimized. We, in one study, had a graduate student who basically modeled sexually harassing behavior. So what he did was talk to a woman in a way, kind of flirting kind of way, and he kind of touched her back and things along those lines. In essence, when you see somebody who is a person in a position of authority do those kinds of things, it kind of legitimizes that sort of behavior. So
that certainly is going to take effect in the workplace. But as a cultural norm, have things changed? You would think that attitudes have changed on the surface, and the public speech surrounding sexually harassing behavior has changed over the last 30-plus years. But has the behavior as revealed in the surveys changed as well?
Well, let me say something about a recent study that I did. I participated with a group of people who are sexual harassment researchers in a project that the New York Times sponsored, and we put together a different kind of survey. We asked people whether they'd actually done things in the last year, and we included some of the kinds of sexually harassing behaviors that have been studied in countless other studies, but they include sexual coercion, they include something called unwanted sexual attention, which is kind of repeated requests for dates, even though you've been told no. And it also included something that we called gender harassment, which is basically hostile sexist behavior, calling women sexist names or telling sexist jokes in the workplace, things along those lines. What we found in the study, which was a national sample of 615 working men, that 25% of the men in the sample said they had done at least one of those things in the last year. I can also say in a pilot study that I did before that with kind of more of a convenient sample, but a sample of working men nonetheless, I find if you extended the time frame out to last 5 years, you get 76% of men saying they've done at least one of those things.
Wow.
And last year. Now that study is one that I hope to replicate with a larger, more scientific sample. But the New York Times sample was a scientific sample. That's one you can kind of take to the bank with regard to it not being something that is selective or that kind of thing. You know?
Is it power? Is it sex?
It's both. It's both power and sex, particularly when you want to talk about something like sexual coercion, because by definition, if you're coercing someone, you have some sort of power over them. You either bribe them or you can punish them. Some of the things, though, that are interestingly connected to I don't know whether it's individual power, but it's sort of male power in some way. One of the things that I found and other people have found is that men who admit to performing sexually harassing behaviors, and this is no shock here, they tend to be more sexist. They tend to be people who basically categorically demean women or look at women in a general negative kind of combative sort of ways, or the war of the sexes kind of thing. Sexist men are more likely to do all the different kinds of sexually harassing behaviors that we've studied. So that comes through in a great many studies.
Is sexual harassment more common the longer a person is in a powerful position?
Well, I don't know if there's any good answer to that question. One of the things I will tell you, though, is that people who are in powerful positions come to believe that those they have power over are attracted to them. There are some clever studies that have been done where you can actually give people power and find that that there's that relationship. And there are other studies that look at people who are in positions where they've actually had power. There may be some connection of sexual harassment, this more coercive kind of thing, and sort of being know, kind of newly in position of power. There's some research that seems to indicate that. So if you hadn't had power before, but now you're in power, then that activates you. That activates it, yeah. But for that to happen, you have to have this sort of connection in your mind between sex and power. There's some complicated relationships when we think about, is it sex or is it power? I would generally say, you know, that it can be both.
But what's to like about non-consent?
What's to like about non-consent?
That seems foreign to a lot of people.
I think that for some people, dominating someone is something that's kind of a sexual charge. It is actually a function of sexuality for men who score high in the likelihood to sexually harass scale. I've asked them that kind of question before. So they look at sex as... You ask them, well, why do you have sex? And there are lots of reasons people have sex. And some of them have to do with domination and power exertion, things like that. And people who have this proclivity for sexual coercion are likely to see, well, dominance is one of the reasons you have sex. Some other things that they talk about are kind of hedonism. Also, things like a relief from boredom and to sort of impress your friends, things along those lines. One of the things you don't see as often in men who are likely to sexually harass is some sense that sex is about some sort of intimacy between two people. So that's also a function of sex. It's a very common one for most people, one of the more prominent ones, that you have sex with people you love, with people, you know, it makes you feel intimate with the person you have sex with. That's not what people who are likely to sexually coerce are likely to feel about sex.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with John Pryor, a distinguished professor emeritus of Illinois State University, about his landmark gold standard study about the likelihood of someone would be a sexual harasser. If people have these attitudes, and if they know it's wrong and do it anyway, how can they be changed?
I guess I would kind of take exception to the idea they know it's wrong and they do it anyway. I think that some people feel entitled to exert themselves. Entitlement is unfortunately something that many people in power seem to feel. That is, because they have wealth and power, they think that they deserve it and they deserve all that goes with it.
Is it fixable?
I think it's fixable in a sense that I think that if you work towards having more women in positions of power and authority in organizations and institutions throughout the country, that's going to be something that's going to undermine the degree to which people who work in those organizations are going to be likely to do these kinds of things. For one thing, if your boss is a female as compared to a male, and you have this kind of thing happen to you, you're more likely to think that you'll be believed when you go complain. There's a suspicion often among women, and I think it's one that they come by honestly, is that they complain and they're not believed, or they say, oh, well, there's another way to look at this from the perspective of the person who's doing these things to you. That's something that they're going to fear less if the person who is their supervisor is some.
John Pryor is a distinguished professor emeritus of psychology at Illinois State University. He's been much in demand recently to help explain the national scandal and national sexual harassment scandal. Pryor spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker for Sound Ideas.